So you have two members flipping. You have the election results that you had. And I guess the first question for the Democrats is, what do you do with a minority of 49? I mean, how do you proceed in the Texas House?
Very carefully. It is the truth. I mean, we've got members with incredible talent, and we've got a good bench. There's a good talent pool. And frankly, we have the advantage of experience. We know where the gears are and how to use them, and we know how to drive the car. So I think we'll be in pretty good shape. Procedurally, there will be some challenges. You know, when you are looking for two-thirds, you can do it all on your own now if you're a Republican. But frankly, I think there is such a divergence, a diversity of viewpoint now on the Republican side, that I don't know that 100 votes on anything, from the rainy day fund to any constitutional amendment, I don't know that 100 votes is a foregone conclusion. So I think Democrats are still a huge part of the process. I mean, frankly, if you look at the speaker's race, I mean, it's still a pretty significant block of votes when you're trying to get to 76. The 49 of us get you more than halfway there. So I expect that, you know, obviously we'll have to play our cards differently and we'll have to be pretty good at the game, but we're going to be up on the front row and we're going to be playing pretty hard.
You've been in the House through a bunch of switches. You know, sure. there was Warren Chisholm back in the day. There was, sure, Kirk England. There was Chuck Hobson a year ago. And now...
Bernard Erickson. Several.
Right. Mm-hmm. Alan Ritter and Aaron Pena go today. Tell me what you think about this.
Well, I mean, on the one hand, you look at the numbers and you look at the politics of it all, and you look at Alan's situation, and, you know, Alan's situation for me is very different from Aaron's. I mean, Alan has a conservative district that is not so far removed from mine. And if you look at the Democratic vote in his district, then you kind of see why he did it. Now, I wouldn't have done it the way he did. I mean, he just got reelected as a Democrat. I am kind of one of those who thinks that, you know, you do the Phil Gramm thing and you start over and you give the district a chance to put their imprimatur, their give you their blessing. But I, you know, I have some understanding. Aaron, for me, is, I'm in a quandary because Aaron's district is not Republican in the least. Many of the programs that are the first to be on the chopping block just because of a philosophical difference between the Republicans and the Democrats are programs that are hugely, hugely important. In fact, they're essential in Aaron's district. You know, if we do anything to 22-1, if we do anything to pre-K, if we do anything to CHIP or nursing homes, Aaron's constituents are going to be disproportionately impacted from my point of view. So Aaron is, for me, a huge disappointment, especially since I remember him, you know, on the front row of the, you know, if I look at pictures of Ardmore, I mean, he's up, you know, standing next to Jim Dunham and Garnet Coleman. If I, you know, the first time I met Aaron, he was running for chairman of the Texas Democratic Party, wanted to be the first Latino to chair the party. And so I have a hard time reconciling the Aaron Pena that I've known for years and whose district I've been to many, many times with the Aaron Pena that that became a Republican today.
How much of this, you know, how much of this is opportunistic? I mean, as you mentioned, Pena's run for Democratic Party chairman before. Alan Ritter was a candidate for speaker 2 years ago. I mean, these guys are both looking for party leadership positions from the Democrats just a minute ago.
Well, I mean, I you know, one of the things about, in my experience about changing parties, there are very few exceptions to the general rule. And the general rule has been that people will, I mean, they'll invite you into the church, but they're not going to make you a deacon. So the idea that you can be part of the leadership by changing, I think, is, you know, I don't think that's how it usually works. I mean, there have been exceptions. But, you know, in my own view, there have to be some core values. I mean, you have to believe in stuff to be here. And the idea that you can look at me in the eyes and say, you know, everything I told you yesterday isn't true. I don't believe everything I told you yesterday anymore and mean it, I have a hard time with that. I have a hard time with that.
As a matter of mechanics in the House, you know, the rules are built for supermajorities to just, you know, parade around and do whatever they want. Now, the Democrats, when they were in power, were famously split. Sort of the liberal Democrats and the conservative Democrats, and, you know, the old line was that there were three parties in the House, the Democrats, and the Republicans.
Do you expect true today?
Well, I was going to ask, do you think that, you know, how do you
think? No, I think that's true today. I think any time that anybody gets a huge majority, you know, frankly, Mark Twain said, you know, anytime I'm part of the majority, it's time to reform. And I think they're looking at themselves in the mirror, and they're realizing this huge diversity of opinion, even among themselves. I mean, you have the traditional Republicans who are fiscally conservative, but socially not so much so. You have the conservatives who are very socially conservative, to the point where this idea of limited government doesn't mean so much, because they're very interested in regulating the bedroom or the bathroom or any other room in the house. And then you have this new phenomenon of the Tea Party, which has come of age lately, and we'll see whether it's a fad or we'll see whether it's a long-term philosophy. But right now, I mean, you see them already. You see the inner conflict, and I think it'll come to a head during redistricting, because there's no, you know, now with 101 members. At some point, you got to throw some of your own guys under the bus. And who's it going to be? And whoever it is isn't going to be very happy about it, and is probably not going to want to go along with the leadership on a lot of other decisions that are being made. That's their leverage.
How smart a time, just politically speaking, if you were a moderate and you felt like in some way...
You mean I'm not a moderate? I always thought I was a moderate.
Suppose you were a moderate member not named Gallego, and you could, in some instance, in some light, find yourself comfortable in some ways in either party. You're trying to decide, is this a good time to switch? Is this an opportune time? I mean, the Republicans have this super majority. You say, you know, you mentioned that, you know, some of these swing seats are now in their hands. Are these the two most valuable members of the party when they're looking at redistricting maps? How does that work?
Well, I think seniority matters. I think the guy who got there first is, you know, a little more significant than the guy who got there last, who kind of took the late train. So, I mean, I think there'll be some loyalty, there'll be some priority given to those folks who have been around for a while. But, you know, again, I look at it in a little different terms. I mean, I look at it as a matter of principle. You know, you want to empower people who think like you do. And, you know, when you have three parties in the House, it's pretty hard to figure out who you're going to be empowering. I'm disappointed today in the sense that, you know, I've had my chances to change parties. I mean, I can tell you there were numerous efforts to made to get me to become a Republican. And my voting record in those days was not so hardcore to the left. After Speaker Craddock came along, it moved significantly to the left, because there wasn't a middle anymore. There was just a right or a left. And we'll see if these guys have that impact, if the Tea Party has that impact of moving everybody to the right and killing off the middle for the Republicans. Because if they kill off the middle, that's also going to be a huge deal in redistricting, to see the kinds of candidates that we start electing from here on out, who can win a primary and who can't. And I think, I would hope that there would be some incentive or some thought to creating districts that normal people, moderate people can win, that don't have to be on one extreme or the other of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party.
What are the incentives? I'll let you escape after this. But what are the incentives to somebody in politics to change parties? I mean, it looks like, you know, there's the obvious thing that you could, you know, my election chances are better than the other party, or I feel like I'll get I'll get a better view if, you know, in my office, or, you know, whatever it is. What are the real true incentives to a politician to change parties? Is it fear, or is it the sense of opportunity in the other direction, or is it really a sense that things have changed under them and they need to move?
You know, I will tell you that from my early days in Alpine Elementary and Alpine Junior High and Alpine High School, I was always taught that survival is man's highest instinct. They switch because they want to keep, they want to stay in the game, they want to climb in the game, and they think the best way to climb is by riding somebody else's animal, riding an elephant instead of a donkey.